Hi, this is Jerry Conway, and you're listening to The Cave of Solitude.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Cave of Solitude, your comic book and pop culture podcast. I am your host, Eric Anthony. And we are really excited to share this week's episode with you as we are once again joined by the Fastball Specials, Martin Slam Duncan, as we have a candid conversation with the legendary comic book writer, Mr. Jerry Conway. And why is this such a big deal for us? Well, if the name doesn't ring a bell, Jerry Conway is the co-creator for such well-known characters as Miss Marvel, The Punisher, Jason Todd, who was the Robin that followed Dick Grayson in the Batman comics, Firestorm and Felicity Smoke, which you may know from the CW's Arrow, as well as Killer Frost and Vibe from the Flash TV show, and many, many others, which, I mean, the list of characters he's created is too long for me to name in this intro right now. But most importantly, at the age of 19 years old, Mr. Conway took over the writing duties from Stan Lee himself on a little comic book called The Amazing Spider-Man, and within that first year of his writing the book, made quite possibly the biggest impact on the mythos of the Spider-Man character by killing off Peter Parker's first true love, Gwen Stacy. That's right, we have the man who killed Gwen Stacy in the Cave of Solitude this week, and it was a real honor to be able to speak with Mr. Conway, and we want to extend our thanks to him for agreeing to be featured on our show. Now, Jerry Conway is still writing books for Marvel Comics, so I highly recommend you check them out, some of which include the current Amazing Spider-Man, Renew Your Vows, which he is collaborating with Ryan Stegman, which is an awesome book. The infamous Spidey villain, Carnage, had his own solo book, which Jerry has finished the run on that, 16 issues, which you can pick up in graphic novels now. And don't forget to check out all of his back catalog and collected editions that Marvel has been putting out in the last few months. And you can find those if you're in the Greater Toronto area at Cyber City Comics, located at 1025A Steeles Avenue West in Toronto. But if you do not live in Canada or in Toronto, hit up your local comic book shop and ask for the collected editions that Jerry Conway has written. You will not be disappointed. His books are a lot of fun. Things from the 70s, from the 80s, and current things that he's writing now. So without further ado, we are proud to present to you our conversation with the legendary comic book writer himself, Mr. Jerry Conway. Okay, so we are very excited this week to welcome our guest. And I have to start off by saying that if there was an official comic book Hall of Fame, then this week's guest would definitely be a no-brainer first ballot, and I think that it would only be right that there be an award category in the comic book industry named after him for whoever has the most impactful single issue of the year. Our guest has created characters such as Firestorm, Miss Marvel, Jason Todd, and some guy named Punisher. I don't think you've ever heard of him. we are very happy today to have with us Mr. Jerry Conway. Thank you so much for joining us. It's a real privilege to have you.
It's my pleasure, guys.
So we're going to try not to cover the most obvious stuff. I mean, people can find your answers about these other questions other places. So let's start off with, why did you kill Gwen Stacy?
Yeah, let's not go with the opposite. Well, the quick answer is John Romita, who is my who's the leader on the book for me at that point, since I was a newcomer to the title, he had a lot of experience with the book, and he thought that it would be useful to change things up a bit by killing off one of the main characters. The character that he wanted to kill off was Aunt May. I felt that she was too integral to the long-term storytelling of the book, too much a part of Peter's entire motivation to be Spider-Man. And I had always felt that Mary Jane was the character who had been positioned to be Peter's, you know, the love of Peter's life. There had been a great deal of build-up to her introduction. Her introduction was just phenomenal, you know, for as a reader, it blew me away. And then after about a year, because Stan, I guess, you know, my personal theory has always been that Stan wanted Peter to have a girlfriend who was like his wife, Joan, who was this very tall, statuesque blonde, you know, very sweet. And that was his wish fulfillment. So he created Gwen Stacy out of really no other, as far as I could tell, no other motivation. So for me, it always felt like Gwen was a misstep, you know, in the direction of Peter's storytelling. And the character I wanted to write as Peter's love interest was Mary Jane. And I thought Mary Jane was a much more fully developed, more interesting character. Absolutely. She had a lot of bite to her. You know, she was very aggressive, very independent. She came from a lower class background like Peter. They had more in common, and yet they were more frictional. So they just seemed like more of a match for storytelling purposes. Gwen, I defy anybody to give me any description of Gwen, other than that she was a pretty girl in go-go boots. You know, she was really nice. That's about all you can say about her. The Emma Stone version was an infinitely better character, you know, in the two Spider-Man movies than the actual Gwen Stacy character from the comics. So that's basically why we went the way we did.
So I have a bit of a theory around that. I was telling Anthony just before the show here. So I reread the run recently, and I did notice that Spider-Man fights the Hulk just prior to this issue, and he catches a cold from a Canadian. So come issue 121, he's trying to stop the Green Goblin, but because of his cold, he is unable to do it in time, which results in the death of Gwen Stacy. So if anybody ever gives you a hard time, you could always blame Canada.
That's great.
Oh, Canada.
And we'll say we're Canadians. Sorry.
Well, that's very polite of you. No, I think that's an interesting take that, you know, the fact that he's not feeling well, you know, does reduce his response time. It gives him a little bit of leeway, you know, in his failure. But I think the larger reason that story had such an impact was because it was a heroic failure. Superheroes aren't supposed to fail, you know, in matters of life and death. Maybe they get there too late. Maybe they get there after the deed is done, you know, something like that. But to actually be there and attempt to save someone and fail, it's a very human situation. It's a reality. Survivor's remorse is a reality. And that had not actually, I think, been expressed in comics before. So I think that's the reason it had such great impact, you know, that and the fact that you know, implied he had some culpability, although, you know, that's always a debatable issue.
I've said to Martin numerous times that a lot of people have their bucket list of which issue they would own, and for me, it's Amazing Spider-Man 121 is the one issue that I would love to have more than any other, more than Amazing Spider-Man or Amazing Fantasy 15, because it just has that. It changed the game completely, and it's something that thankfully they haven't reversed. So I'm glad that it stuck.
Yeah.
Thank you. Initial question, I mean, I love the answer you gave, because I was trying to crack a joke, but that was so informative. That was great. you're among the first generation of writers, I would say, who really wanted to be comic book writers. You hear Stan Lee always say that, you know, he was kind of embarrassed about being a comic book writer because he wanted to be a novelist. But for you, why and how did you get your shot at being a comic book writer? How did it start?
Well, I was I lived in New York, which was a major advantage at that point, because the entire comic book industry was basically the five boroughs of New York City. And I think I read in a comic Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes, or Adventure Comics, about Jim Shooter, who was this 13-year-old kid, and I was 13, who was writing comic books. And I knew that I wanted to be a writer. I had always tried to draw my own comics. I knew I wasn't really a very good artist. So my goal was to somehow do what Jim Shooter had done, even though we had lived very different, you know, lives and very different reasons for doing what we did. So one summer, I convinced my dad to take me and my friend into Manhattan, where I had discovered that DC was doing a tour. Every Thursday, they did this tour during the summer of their offices. And at that tour, after going through it once, I met some other people who were trying to break into comics, a guy named Marv Wolfman and another, and his friend Len Wein. And the two of them were doing this interesting thing, which was that they were splitting off from the rest of the tour as soon as we got in the doors, and they would go talk to the different editors. So I started going on the tour every week that summer. I would take the subway to Manhattan and go on the tour and then break off and go talk to the different editors and try to promote myself as somebody who wanted to write for them. I did this for the following year, the school year, after school, about once a week, I would take the subway into Manhattan and go up to the offices and talk with the different editors that I had met about story ideas. Eventually, that led to when Carmen Infantino came in as the editor-in-chief publisher, he brought in some new editors, one of whom was Dick Giordano, who very kindly took me under his wing and gave me a lot of advice. And the summer that I turned, the summer that I was 15 years old, I was going up to Dick's office a lot that spring. And he shared an office with Joe Orlando and an editor named Murray Boltonoff. And apparently Murray Boltonoff became convinced that I was working for Dick. And since Dick was a fair-haired boy at the company, Murray wanted to get a piece of that action. So he asked me if I'd be interested in doing a story for him. And I said, oh, sure. And I spent about 6 weeks rewriting a 3-page story for Murray that eventually he decided was, you know, good enough. And he asked me what my page rate was for writing for DC. And I said, well, I don't know. I've never actually sold anything here before. And the color drained out of his face. And he realized that he had just bought, you know, a newcomer's first story, which Murray would never do. So that's how I broke in. And then from there, Dick decided that he could use me. And I started writing more stories for Dick. Eventually, you know, met some people at Marvel and started writing for Roy Thomas at Marvel. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Fantastic. I'm going to go a little bit on the dark side here. Tomb of Dracula and Werewolf by Night, some of your earlier work. I started sort of going back and reading some of this. It's fantastic stuff. Were you a fan of the Universal Monsters growing up?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. When I was growing up in the 50s, there was this in New York City, there was this Channel 9 that, you know, every local station back in those days had, every city had a local station that would do spooky theater type things, you know, where yep. We had this, in New York, it was a guy named Zachary. And Zachary, I don't know whether he did it during the afternoons or not, but there was an afternoon show that ran old Universal movies. It was called The Early Show. And they ran all of the Frankenstein movies, the King Kong, Dracula, you know, that whole Universal Monsters sequence. And I was addicted to that. They also ran, like, the Commando Cody films, you know, the Rocket Man, all of the stuff that later got ripped off, you know, as serials, you know, I mean, I basically, like, I'm George Lucas in that regard, in that I grew up on the same stuff he grew up on. I think he may have seen some of it in theaters, but most of it he probably saw on TV, just like me. And that's where we both, you know, we keep alive. What's so bizarre is all the cartoons, the movies, the references that I have from my childhood are actually from the 1930s. Because that's the movies that we're showing and the cartoons that were showing on TV when I was growing up. So I have like 1930s movie Western serials in my head. I have 1930s horror movies. I have 1920s and 30s cartoons, you know, Betty Boop cartoons in my head. I mean, all this stuff is what I grew up on. So it's sort of like the Three Stooges, for God's sake, are the 1930s, but they're also the 1950s.
Yeah.
So it's kind of bizarre. It's sort of like my daughter has grown up. She's 21 now, but she's grown up with 60s nostalgia in her head. You know, she knows Creedence Clearwater. She watches, you know, she talks about movies and TV shows that were gone years before she was, you know, alive. That's her cultural touchstone. So it seems like we're all about 20 years behind.
Excellent.
So during your tenure in the 70s, you wrote really influential runs, obviously on Spider-Man, and Martin brought up, you know, you did Tomb of Dracula and Werewolf by Night, and then you did a lot of work with DC as well. What were the differences, the pros and cons between those two companies as far as what you were able to do with the characters and even editorial? Were there freedoms that we had with one and not the other?
Well, yeah, because at Marvel it was chaos. Marvel had when I first started working for Marvel in 1970, they were publishing 12 titles a month. By the time I left around 1975, they were publishing upwards of 50 titles a month, and they had the same size editorial staff. So there was very little oversight as the company expanded. And that was both good and bad. Obviously, there was a great deal of inconsistency in the quality of my work at Marvel during the early 70s. But there was also a tremendous amount of freedom for people to chart their own paths. So you had people like myself, like Steve Englehart, like Steve Gerber, Don McGregor, all sort of staking out our own territory in terms of how we were interpreting the Marvel Universe. And bits and pieces of all of those different visions, you know, then were amalgamated in the 80s and 90s as Marvel solidified an editorial point of view. So that was cool. At DC, you had kind of the opposite problem, where there was a much tighter editorial structure, and each editor had their own viewpoint and their own approach to how to tell a great superhero story or a great horror story or a great, you know, genre story. You know, writing for Julie Schwartz was very different than writing for Murray Boltanoff, which was very different from writing for Dick Giordano, which was very different from writing for Joe Orlando. So where I as a creator could find different ways to express myself with those different editors, it was harder for me to just go off on my own and develop my own individualistic style under those editors. I think I did, you know, I mean, I think you can see a continuity in my storytelling, but, yeah. You know, it's very different. I think the thing that came closest to the way that I would have written a Marvel book is Firestorm, you know, which I basically controlled as the editor-writer of that book. But I also had a lot of freedom working with Len Wein on Batman.
Okay.
you know, and a great deal of freedom, you know, with other editors on other projects. So it's just a different approach. And now I'd say both companies are kind of the same in their approach. And I think it's actually unfortunate because they both have this kind of top-down marketing approach now, where everything has to fit into a marketing plan.
Right.
And individual creativity is sort of secondary.
That's interesting. I've heard that we were talking to another creator last episode, and he said the same thing, that with the two big companies, they always build things. First, they have a marketing plan, then you have a story, as opposed to it being story first and build the marketing around the creativity of those characters.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, in certain cases, people break through. You know, I mean, like Matt Fracton's Hawkeye was a terrific example of creativity. Same thing with his wife, Kelly Sue DeConnick, you know, on Captain Marvel and Ms. Marvel and so on. Those books, and then what inevitably happens is they get throttled, you know, because they have to then fit them into the marketing plan. And that's unfortunate, but, you know, it is what it is.
So I'm gonna jump over a little bit over to some of your story writing, screenwriting. Mm-hmm. I'm a huge Conan fan, and I've read you run on Conan Savage Sword, but Conan the Destroyer. I have a couple of questions about that. So I'm a fan of the film.
I really am. Yeah.
So in the first film, we get Thulsa Doom as the main villain, and in the second one, we do get Toth Amon, which is probably one of the more famous villains of the Conan lore. But the main villain was Queen Terramis. What was the choice behind that?
Well, it's all part of the process of how that film came about. And how it went through a variety of changes pre-production. Originally, Roy Thomas and I were hired by Ed Pressman, who was the producer of the first Conan film, on the record, to write the script for the second one with a director named Ronald Donaldson. Donaldson, you'll know him as a pretty decent 1980s director of films like The Bounty, No Way Out. Really, really smart guy. And we sat down and broke down a story with Roger that in its bones is what Conan the Destroyer was, but had a much more epic scale to it. I don't think it was actually producible in 1982 or whenever it was that we did it without major changes. I mean, I know a lot more now after 30 years of working in TV and film about what you can and can't do. But you know, for a first draft, it succeeded on a couple of levels. One, it got Arnold Schwarzenegger to agree to do this second movie.
Right.
And two, it got... Ed Pressman was able to sell the project off to Dino De Laurentiis, which got Ed a big payday and left Roger and Roy and I somewhat in the lurch. At that point, we went from having a project that involved Barry Smith as a story artist for the project, and Roger as the director and Roy and I as the writers, to a situation in which Dino, who had a commitment to start filming The Bounty in like 6 weeks, he offered Roger the opportunity to do that. And Roger's from New Zealand, so the idea of going to Australia and shooting The Bounty was much more appealing to him than being in Los Angeles and shooting Mexico or wherever or Spain or wherever it was we were going to shoot Conan. So he dropped out of the project, which left us without a director. Then Dino basically said, we're going to shoot this in Mexico using the sets from Dune. We're going to redress them. As soon as Dune is finished shooting, that's when we're gonna start shooting this. And one of his first, the next thing was Barry was told to take a walk, so we didn't have an artist. And it became down to Roy and I. And because of the nature of our screenwriting contract on the project, Dino had the option to keep us writing new drafts for up to 6 full drafts of the film. And he would bring in directors. We would work with the director for a new draft. And these directors were not working, they were not being paid. They were just sort of like saying, hey, what would you like to do with this movie? So they would come in and they'd do their version of the movie, and we would write a draft with them, and then they'd be told, thank you, but no. And this went on for about almost a year. We were actually the ones who suggested the casting of Grace Jones for Zula. So that was our major contribution aesthetically to that film.
I was actually going to ask you about that. So Bombada and Zula, did you have Wilt Chamberlain and Grace Jones in mind when you...
Not have Wilt Chamberlain in mind.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
We wanted an actor. But, you know, Dino was always into casting for marketing reasons. You know, he figured he could cast Wilt Chamberlain and there'd be some audience that would want to see Wilt Chamberlain in a movie. That's how he did it. But anyway, we ended up finally with a lot of elements of our original draft still in the script at the time that the director that did do the movie was hired. And by this point, we were both pretty demoralized, but we were still, you know, feeling pretty good. And that director was Richard Lester. And I actually thought, wow, Richard Lester, this is a guy who directed one of my favorite barbarian movies of all time, The Vikings. Yes. And I thought, if anybody can do Conan the Barbarian, it's Richard Lester, because, you know, he's both a terrific genre director and showed that he understood this kind of heroic myth type storytelling. You know, I still think of that great scene of the Viking war dance that Kirk Douglas did in that film. Terrific piece of work. So we go into this meeting with Richard Lester, and I'm actually feeling pretty pumped, but I'm also feeling pretty disgusted because we've been working for a year with different directors, and I don't know whether this one's going to go anywhere anyway. But there was a scene in the script that I always tell this story because it's sort of emblematic of everything that happened to that film. There's a scene in the script that had been in the first draft and every subsequent draft. The premise was, if you remember in the film, there's a tower that Conan and his allies have to get to.
Yeah.
And at the top of the tower, there's a bad guy. Well, the way we had structured this was, Conan himself was going to go into the tower. He had to swim in through an underground watery passage that led up through a cistern into the base of the tower, where there was this chamber that was filled with these leeches that he had to climb up past, you know, out through a grate and lift the grate off with his great massive arms and toss it aside. And then there was a spiraling staircase that went up through the center of the tower all the way up to the top, where Conan was going to get the jewel that he needed to get. And then an army of warriors were going to come up to attack him. And the only way that he could get out was to dive off that top of the balcony down to the center of the tower, through that grate, through the cistern, and into the water. And it was going to be fucking spectacular, right?
I want to see that movie.
Right? And this had survived every single draft of the film. And it was like we were holding on to it as our lodestone because we knew this was the scene that was going to just get everybody in the audience out of their seats and say, holy shit. So the first thing Richard Lester says to us as we sit down is, you know, there's a scene here in the tower
where you got this guy climbing up and he has to dive off. We got to lose that. And I'm like, what?
No.
Why? Why? He said, because it's going to be hard to do. And I just blew up. You know, I said, we have to put something in this fucking movie that's hard to do that the audience can, you know, will like. You know, it's like we're taking everything out of this movie. And Lester just sort of looked at me and said, uh-huh. And then we were told after the meeting that our services were no longer desired.
That's the same guy who came up with the cellophane Superman S, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I've just done a horrible thing. It's not Richard Lester who directed the Superman movies. It was Richard Fleischer. Richard Fleischer, the son of Dave and Max Fleischer. Richard Fleischer directed the Vikings. He directed Raw Story. He directed the Boston Strangler. He's a terrific director, Richard Fleischer. He did Tora. If you haven't seen the Vikings, go watch the Vikings. This guy was a first-class director in the – he directed 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, okay? So
yeah, I love that movie.
The guy was a great director. And as I said, this is the guy who I thought, oh, my God, this is great that we've got this guy. And literally by that point, he was almost 80 years old, and he just didn't want to be bothered. You know, so I was just – you know, I was the young punk, you know, who called him out. And you know, Richard Lester would have done that scene. Richard Lester would have done it. I mean, and let's not give him too much crap. The cellophane Superman thing.
I loved it as a kid.
God only knows where
as
that
a kid,
came
I loved
from.
That. That was the coolest thing.
Yeah, but he did some great stuff in those movies. And he directed the Three and Four Musketeer movies, which were terrific.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, the guy has chops. But Fleischer was just a tired old man at that point. He just didn't want to be bothered. Anyway, I can relate to him now. I probably wouldn't want to do that scene either, but I would have done it.
So seeing how they do from being in the business then and what they wouldn't do because it seemed too hard, and now you get to see on television and in the movies all of these a lot of the characters you created on the screen. What's your do you enjoy these movies? What's your opinion of the stuff that's coming out almost in every corner that every time you turn a television channel, there's something there in regards to comic books now?
I know. I think it's great. I think when it's well done, it is awesome. I mean, this is now the language. I'd say this is the modern version of the Western, you know, the modern version of the space opera. It's the mythology that we use to understand our lives, you know. Comics are a tricky field. You know, they're many things. I mean, they're not just superheroes,
but
superheroes are sort of the mythology of comics. Right. You know, they're the way that most stories are told, or many stories are told. And to see them, especially to see them when they're done well, you know, like the Wonder Woman movie or Guardians of the Galaxy or you know, the stuff on the CW, the best stuff on the CW. It's a thrill, you know, and it's very surreal for someone like me who was working in the field at a time in the early 70s when we all honestly all thought that the business had maybe 10 years. You know, the sales had been dropping over the previous decade, year by year by year. And while Marvel was catching up to DC in terms of market share, it was a very small market that was shrinking every year. So to see it now be the dominant mythology of the time is just, it's weird. You know, it'd be like, it would be if you had told somebody in 1925 that ragtime was going to be the dominant music of the 1970s. You know, it wouldn't have been, it didn't become that, but, you know, it would have been like, what? What are you talking about? You know, it's very hard to conceptualize this, or even take rock and roll.
rock and roll in the 1950s was outsider music. By the 1960s, it was protest music. By now, it's just the Muzak. You know, it's the baseline that everything else is sort of riffing on. So that's weird, you know, for people like me who've lived long enough to really have any kind of personal historical perspective. I love it. You know, I mean, it's my fanboy dream come true.
We're very fortunate today.
Oh, yes.
I have a few questions from some of the listeners of the podcast. If I could maybe rapid fire some of these off very quickly. I have a combination question here because they're very similar. So Sharon Weatherby and Suzanne Chevalier, very similar question. Does he have any routines that he follows when he's writing, like must have a particular snack or drink? Sue asks, does he eat snacks? So I guess they're very curious about your snacks. Or wears superhero pajamas when he writes. Does he have a lucky? Does he have a lucky pen? And where does he write?
Well, all of those are actually oddly they all tie together. I don't wear any superhero pajamas because I usually write at coffee shops or in a public mall. I write on my iPad. I usually have coffee I find that being in the presence of other people sort of allows me to focus my attention more. When I'm sitting alone in my in an office, I used to be able to concentrate and focus, but now I just get more distracted. I get bored. Russ Andrew, the artist I worked with on Spider-Man, once told me that he had read somewhere, and for him it was true, that if you put your desk, if you put your board, you know, your art board by a window, it actually helps your productivity because your eyes wander and look out.
Interesting.
And you know, when you're, and that in the outside input of seeing a tree blow or seeing a bird fly by or whatever it is, gives your mind a momentary rest, and then focuses your attention right back on the material.
Right.
Since I write about people, I find being around people is actually really helpful to me. Partly that's because of 20 years of writing television, where I wrote in an office where other people had offices in the same area. And we would get up and, you know, wander out and drink coffee together and interrupt each other's work and feedback on each other. So I got into the habit of being semi-social.
Right.
So I need to hear voices now, where before I didn't.
Arnold Trinidad asks, or actually first he says he's a really big fan of your co-creation Firestorm, the Ronnie Raymond version. And of all the current popular artists, who would you like to collaborate with if you had an opportunity to write for Firestorm a special issue?
Oh, wow. God, it's like every week I see a new artist that the guy I was doing Renew Your Vows with, Ryan Stegman, is actually almost the ideal artist that I'd like to work
Phenomenal
with.
Phenomenal book. Great book.
He's such a great storyteller. He's a visually dynamic artist, and he understands character. He tells scenes from a character point of view. So even while you're seeing something that's spectacular, it's really oriented in the character's experience of the scene. And I love that about him. So he's like my idealized current version of a superhero artist.
I have a question from Daff J. She has two questions. One of them is, having written the Spider-Man story 121 when you were 19, would you have changed anything that you've done, or would you keep the death the same? And in regards to Renew Your Vows, do you prefer writing married Peter Parker or single Peter Parker?
Well, it's sort of interesting. I actually think that in my heart of hearts, I wish that they had never married him off. Because I think, and I also wish that he'd never graduated college. Because to me, Peter Parker should be this young guy struggling to find his way in the world. That to me was the Peter Parker I identified with. But that's not the Peter Parker we have today in comics. So my preference is to write Peter Ruth Mary Jane. And I was saying to somebody a few years ago that it would be hard for me today to write Peter Parker the way that I had written him when I was 19, because I was writing about somebody who was just like me. You know, those storylines, with the exception of, you know, throwing women off of a bridge and, you know, killing superheroes, had a real connection to my own personal life. You know, when Peter was struggling to find an apartment, that was similar to my struggles. When Peter was dealing with publishers and editors, you know, who were giving him a hard time over his work, that was my story. You know, it's like all of that stuff resonated with me. And I said to somebody, you know, I'm not that guy now. So in a way, it would be kind of weird for me to write Peter Parker authentically. However, when Nick Lowe offered Renew Your Vows to me, I immediately wanted to do it because I could relate to raising a 10-year-old or 8-year-old daughter, because I've done that twice. Right. You know? And I've been a young married husband, you know, and I'm a, you know, newly married husband now. So dealing with relationship issues in a marriage, in a happy marriage, is something that I could, you know, really get my teeth into. That was an appealing pitch to me. And I think, you know, it spoke to me in a way that, you know, writing young Peter Parker wouldn't speak to me authentically today.
Huh. Nicholas Lukic, sorry, this is the last one here, would like to know, I'm going to paraphrase on this one. Basically, he's asking, how do you get into the heads of your characters? Like, are you in some way a method writer?
I am. One thing that as I just said with Peter, writing Peter required me to, or one of the reasons I was able to write Peter the way that I did back in the early 70s and then in the mid 80s was because I was similar to him, you know, and I could put myself into his head. But obviously, I'm not like Batman. You know, I'm not like Bruce Wayne. But you can try to create an empathy with that character. And even the villains, you have to have an empathy with their point of view. You always have to be clear about what they want and why they want it, and believe that they're right on some level, you know, that their take on the world is genuine. You know, they're not irrational people, or if they are irrational, you have to try to understand that from an, you know, what's the, like I wrote Carnage for a year and a half and really liked writing.
How'd you do method
that.
Acting for that one? Writing for that one.
Well, I mean, I just sort of said, yeah, I mean, what you try to do is you try to say, okay, my point of view on the world is that the world is my oyster and I want to eat it. You know? And that he's also driven by this sense of inadequacy that he's making up for by, you know, killing everything. That's his... That's, I think, when you talk about serial killers, you're talking about somebody who on some fundamental level has no self-worth and is trying to, you know, make that reality for other people. You know, he enhances himself by destroying others. So while I can't, you know, literally empathize with it, I can understand it and try to put myself in his shoes. And then it also helps that I think he's a pretty funny character. You know, that his way of talking and his way of behaving is kind of funny, you know, so writing him as humorous is sort of a way to deal with the horror of that type of mentality.
I have one final question that I need to ask a seasoned vet, and it's
sure.
Spider-Man and Batman, who has the better rogues gallery? Having written both of those guys.
Wow.
You'd be the guy to ask.
That's an interesting question. Well, the weird thing I found when I came back to writing Spider-Man is that a lot of his
traditional rogues gallery have been underpowered, you know, and defanged to a degree. You know, he used to be able to go up against a character like Tombstone or Hammerhead and be really threatened by that. Now he's kind of a galactic hero. So, you know, you have to put him up against a character like Regent. So in that sense, his rogues gallery is no longer as impressive. You know, this the Secret Six or the Sinister Six just wouldn't play as dangerous today as it had. Batman's rogues gallery, I think, is more to scale with Batman. So, you know, the Joker is still a major threat to Batman. Two-Face is still a major threat to Batman. You know, so in that sense, while I think that Spider-Man's rogues gallery is in a lot of ways an extremely powerful rogues gallery, not for the current iteration of Spider-Man. I don't really see challenges for him in the traditional rogues gallery that he had. Batman, though, you know, still has characters who can really put him to the test. So, you know, there you go. I don't know whether that's a full answer or not.
I like it. Thank you so much.
Cool.
Thank you for giving so much of your time this evening. We really appreciate it. It's an honor to have you on with us.
It was a pleasure for me too, guys. Yeah.
Absolute thrill. Thank you.
Take care, everybody.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, there you have it, folks. We hope you enjoyed our conversation with the legendary Jerry Conway. It was a ton of fun. As you can see, we had a good time talking about some of the old comics, some of the movies that he's worked on, some of the current things, and just seeing what he thought between Spider-Man and Batman. That was something that I thought for sure he would pick Spider-Man, but lo and behold, Daft J, you got a win in your column again. Even the guy who has written as much Spider-Man as Jerry Conway chose Batman. Well, thank you again for joining us. We hope you had a good time. Thank you to Martin Slam Duncan for joining us, as well as the legendary Jerry Conway. And don't forget, if you do want to read some of his current work or his past work, visit Cyber City Comics if you live in the Greater Toronto area. Pick up these books. They're a lot of fun. They're essential to have on your shelf. And also, don't forget to rate and review us at iTunes. Believe it or not, your reviews do make a difference. And for listener feedback, please email us at caveofsolitude@outlook.com. Don't forget to visit www.thefastballspecial.com as well. We thank you for listening to the show, and we will talk to you soon. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.